I'm a low spark of high healing.
Yeah, I was gonna say you're a low spark of a high heeled boy.
So I still believe.
Yes.
That high heeled boys are really just a dig at all those little mod guys, little mod boys.
Well, if it would have been, you know, like with David Lee Roth, I could see, you know.
No, no. There was this whole, like, whatever that, you know, fashion.
What was that? What was that, 69?
Oh, 67.
Is when that album was?
68, yeah. It was early.
Wow. So was that?
Was maybe it was 69. I don't know.
Because which album was it on?
Low Spark of Hell of Boys. That was the name
of
it.
Low Spark, yeah.
Yeah, but that, I think that was later in the churn.
They broke up in 70.
Mr. Fantasy, right. They broke up in 70. Mr. Fantasy was 68?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. Let's see. Let's see what we can find out.
So Traffic was probably 67. Traffic was probably 67.
You know, this is such a great room. You can't even get internet in here.
There you go.
You can get it, but it has to be there.
Oh, now speak now. Low Spark of High Heeled Boys. It's still listening. Low Spark of High Heeled Boys. There it is. Low Spark of High Heeled Boys. Low Spark of High Heeled Boys. 71 album.
Yeah, that's how I thought. So that was 70, later.
Yeah, so okay.
So
yeah.
Was Lead 4.
Lead 4 was 71? Yeah, that sounds about right. Barleycorn was 70. Mr. Fantasy was 67. Yeah.
And when was
Shoot
the first?
Out at the Fantasy.
When was the first album, Traffic? Because the first album was Traffic, I think it was called.
No, I think it was Mr. Fantasy, wasn't it?
No. Was it called Mr. Fantasy? I thought that.
Yeah, I think the first was Mr. Let's see.
Are we ready to start?
We've been ready.
Oh, okay.
I've never been ready.
Actually, what I'm going to do is just let this roll, and then I
okay, that's fine, because post. I have, so I'll let you finish that. Then I have a statement and question. So did you, so Mr. Fantasy was 67.
I stopped looking.
No. But
yes.
here's the thing. So
you got to record all this part.
It's gone.
Okay,
it's
good.
A brand new documentary done by Jacob Dylan. Called Echoes of the Canyon or Echoes in the Canyon. It's all about
Joni Mitchell.
It's all about Laurel Canyon, Canyon between 1965 and 67. And so I want to talk about that time period because the documentary exposed a number of things that I hadn't thought about in a long time. And it predates the Joni Mitchell entrance into that whole confluence of recording. It has Crosby, Stills, and Young, and Graham Nash somehow involved in different parts of this because of the fact that Buffalo Springfield, the Byrds, and Judy Collins all, and the Youngbloods, were all of that era.
Right. There was 60. So 66 is Buffalo Springfield or 65?
65, 66. And so the interesting part that they talked about to start, trigger this conversation is they had Roger McGuinn in this documentary, Stephen Stills, obviously, Graham Nash, and David Crosby just kept on blah, 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 carrying on, and making himself the pivotal person where we could argue that point over, around, and under, and through. But nonetheless, I'm going to start off this part of this conversation by talking about Roger McGuinn talking about recording Mr. Tambourine Man.
Right.
And he talked about the fact that when he first played it, Dylan somehow got a test recording of it and said, play that for me again. So he went to go see Roger McGuinn, and literally Almost in the next moment, what did Dylan do? He became Dylan Plugged. So I checked it out. I read the, you know, the dates of Dylan at Newport, 1965. Who plays with him that night?
Everybody played with him.
But that night in particular for that set. You ready? Michael Bloomfield on guitar, Al Kooper on keyboard, and Dylan were the primary components of Dylan Electrified, and McGuinn was told, as through Jacob Dylan, that became and changed the electrification of folk, which in their mind launched the birth of rock and roll as we know it in that period of time.
Well, I won't go that far because other bands were actually doing that besides Bob Dylan. Now, Bob Dylan may have been the premier folk artist that went electric. But
no, they didn't credit Dylan. They didn't credit Dylan. They credit McGuinn.
Exactly. So, but if you look at Stephen Stills' background and Neil Young's background,
exactly.
That's a whole different lineage out of Toronto and other places that had nothing to do with Dylan at all.
But where did they go and record? And where they go to play? And who were they playing with at the same time in the same area?
Well, they were in L.A., certainly.
They were in Laurel Canyon playing with all Mamas and Papas.
Mamas and Papas are up north.
They came down. They were there. They talked about it. They talked about hanging out together and being a part of it and all being cross-influenced at that very moment. And like I said, just slightly predates Joni Mitchell and that whole influence of playing, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man, Turn, Turn, Turn. So think about Turn, 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 a biblical.
Oh, I know. It was a big hit.
But where did you ever hear something like that?
Oh, I mean, there's a whole history, like the Brothers Four and all this other stuff that went right into that. I mean, there's all this folk,
but didn't become
Christian music that there's like there's tons of it that and Peter, Paul, and Mary's in the middle of all that sort of stuff.
But not electric, and not with the guitar playing style that they talk about, and there's clips of Stephen Stills and clips of Neil Young from Buffalo Springfield, and you know the early days of you know almost the pre-Poco Jim Messina.
Well, there's the
Richie
Burrito
Fury,
Brothers, and there's a bunch of that whole group that all were picking up electric guitars and playing in 65 and 66, Graham Nash out of the Hollies, so he was
correct.
This is Europe, not the,
right.
You know, the, but they were
well,
doing the same thing.
He went there because of that whole thing. So they talk about, and interesting, they talk about the Beatles showing up because they get a phone call that said, oh, all these cool guys are hanging out. You should come hang out with them. So all these guys are in a hot tub naked, you know, smoking and hanging out. And they heard that the Beatles were on their way, so they all jumped out of the hot tub and all got dressed. And they said, oh, dude, where's the party? What happened?
So at the same time, though, I mean, so I think it's as much as I appreciate the movement from folk to rock. So, I mean, there was other things in Southern California, very big at the time. Certainly, surf music was,
and that was going to be the next piece
because
about.
They were the other half of that Southern California equation, and it's the Jan and Dean, the beginning of the Beach Boys, and there's a ton of it, and the Turtles, and which are not quite part of the same crew, but part of Zappa's crew that was 66,
and they talk about Brian Wilson hearing about these guys. Showing up with his convertible, pulling up and saying, I heard you guys are hanging out and playing. He asked some guy for two tabs of speed and then spends the next 12 hours writing a song with Stephen Stills. Stephen Stills goes to bed, wakes up the next morning, and Brian's finishing the same song that he's been playing for the last 11 hours.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And they talk about that seminal moment of the guy, one of the guys there, Lou Adler, taking the master pressing of Pet Sounds with him to London.
Well, that was much later, though.
No, this is 60. Excuse me, it was the middle of 67. He takes it on a plane, and he goes to Abbey Roads, and he plays it for Paul Lennon, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and Mick Jagger, and they go, "Oh crap! Now we got to up our game." And so they record "Sgt. Pepper's" and Her Majesty's. Majesty's Satanic Request. And so it's a interesting sort of that. So I've always thought about the era of, 59 to 69 and all of that, and how that influenced itself. And, you know, where everybody says, oh, it's a decade, so to speak, but it seems like it always goes from that 9 to 9, 69 to 79, 79 to 89. But in this case, there's those 2 years, which I really feel, maybe yes, maybe no, don't get the significance of the prominence of it. As, you hit 67, it becomes Haight Ashbury, it becomes that whole, electric scene. Joplin comes hard onto the scene. Hendrix is starting to come hard onto the scene. A bunch of other players, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and then Young come out because they leave, the Young Bloods, and those groups deform and become the next level of magical groups.
I'll say there's a couple things that happened in that era that were both new and formative for rock. Was certainly the Newport Jazz Festival, and which became the Newport Rock Festival effectively. Was as much jazz as it was
folk
and rock. But before that festival, there weren't big festivals. I mean, there were festivals, don't get me wrong, but they weren't really big ones. And they were the precursor to Woodstock, of course, which blew
Monterey Pop.
And Monterey Pop Festival. So those. But it went from Newport, Monterey, Woodstock, and Woodstock was so large that they almost killed the idea of having festivals of that size or anything, because what are you going to do with 300,000 people or half a million?
Put them on a farm.
Yeah.
It would have 3 days of love, peace, and mud or
yeah.
something.
So when you look at those years, and I would say, 59 to 69, or maybe it's 61 to 71. I mean, that there, you can play around with that decade. Very similar in the U.S., but you look at critical years, and maybe 64, 65, 66 are really critical for American music. You look at 61, 62, 63, and say those were critical in the U.K. That was the birth of the whole American invasion, the British invasion. We get the Animals and the Birds. I mean, the Who and the Beatles and the Stones. Just like it just changed the way Americans listened to music because of the British invasion. But the West Coast was primarily homegrown,
mm-hmm.
not
Well, so you think about what you just said. So those bands were as much influenced by the inner city music or the urban music or the race music, mm-hmm. In air quotes that people would talk about, as Elvis was influenced by that, and how these records, got brought into the UK, and that's how the Rolling Stones started out.
So I'll say this: we have Motown and we have Sun Records. As the two sort of like different, also starting in the '60s, Late 50s. Late 50s.
Well, starting in 51.
Yeah, but you get that. You get Elvis and you get Motown happening as two other centers of American music. So you know what we're drawing here is, you know, Detroit, Nashville, Memphis,
Philly.
Yeah, but
yeah, but Philly's later on.
Philly's a little bit later.
Philly was early too.
No, Philly didn't really come on the scene till the mid to late '60s because everybody wanted to, Bell and all those guys wanted to be the next Barry Gordy.
Yeah, but you know, back to your Southern California, you have Southern California and you have Haight, as the two
right.
You know, so two West Coast centers. And it's
and different kind of music.
Oh, very different kind of music. Very different kind of music. And if you read like the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, there's some very interesting conversations with how the Dead and Airplane and all these bands up north were listening to every single thing the Beatles did religiously. And not that they're going to play like them, but it was like, these guys are on to something. And it went from more melodic, is early, you know, melodic rock days to by the time you hit the White Album that era, it's like everybody's taking acid and everybody's listening to the albums. And they got their magic bus and drove across the country just like, you know, the Magical Mystery Tour. It was like, but there was this influence, and I'm not going to say that, because we want to go back to the Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan has a profound effect on all music the way the Beatles had a profound effect on all music. And if you take those two as sort of or two groups, two lineages, and you think the Stones, maybe a third, as a just terribly affecting to American music.
I would argue that you're ignoring Mr. Brian Wilson, who, according to, as I said, the interviews and what I heard and my own thoughts about it, Brian was doing things harmonically, doing things orchestrally that people like George Martin from the Beatles were listening to as well and going, I need to bring an orchestra into Abbey Road.
Right. No, I agree. So you get... But it's interesting in the same fashion that Berry Gordy and other producers
absolutely
were really instrumental. But I would say that the lineage of Brian Wilson is not so much musical as it was production, which is really interesting.
And production and writing.
Yeah. So because the whole Beach sound, while still they still tour, of course. But that was sort of this one little moment, and nothing came out of it. You know, I mean, other than maybe some reunion tours of, you know, Beach Guys. But it's like an era of Annette Funicello and Beach Party Bingo.
Yeah, but I don't think that Beach music should be considered the Brian Wilson's only legacy. And I don't think
No, I'm saying his production techniques or his legacy.
Right.
The music itself, while, I'm not going to argue whether it's great music, you like it, you don't like it, but I will say it is so unique to American music, the Beach sound. Nobody else did anything like it. Actually some Japanese bands did some Beach music, which is kind of odd. But
well, they got Beaches. Yeah. They got Beaches.
I know, but it's really sort of an homage to the Southern California sound. But it's, to me, other bands, you can clearly see their lineage grow, after the Dead and, after the Airplane, you can see how other bands took up that sort of, feeling from them. With the Beach Boys, they were it. I mean, they built on other people. But not, they were part of a, the ventures and all that other stuff that was happening at the time.
See, I would argue that they didn't build on others. I would argue that they were one of those moment of ones, you know, what do they call it? Patient zero, or however you want to call it, that there were things that Brian came up with first that other people didn't really think about yet.
Well, I
and, you know, the things about,
the,
you know, using the dogs. The, you know, I mean, come on. Who in the 60s came up with, I'm going to bring a bunch of dogs in as part of a song, or I'm going to bring in bells as part of a song, until you got to Michael, you know, Tubular Bells and other stuff like that. I'm sorry. I think that there's some unique, there's some, and Brian's mad, don't get me wrong, but there is genius in that madness.
So give another mad person, Sid Barrett did the same thing for early, really early Pink Floyd. When you get 64, 65 Pink Floyd, and you've got, well, he's crazy, but on the other hand,
it's
he's
amazing.
Got dogs, he's got cats, but, he's frying his eggs, and you're listening to him
well,
fry
the telephone,
eggs.
Well, the telephone, or, you know, for the opening of a song.
Yep.
You know, and you know that overseas call, and you know the person hangs up on the call.
That's an old technique in blues.
Absolutely. But again, so I don't see him. I think he's genius, but he was not. Again, that guy zero. Yeah. There were guys before that, and mind you, there are some original ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, but.
So I like I think that Brian Wilson actually is undercredited.
Undercredited is a good word.
Just because the Beach Boys are sort of that band that people peg as, oh, there's the beach sound, and you know it just sounds like every song other than maybe Good Vibrations sounds exactly the same, you know, sort of thing, because of the top 40-ness of it, not because. All the B-sides, other things that you don't hear that often, but the top 40 songs are very similar to each other, and it's that Chuck Berry-esque lyrical quality, you know, and it's very Chuck Berry, and it's very Jan and Dean. There's a lot of it.
Yeah, but so let's go with Chuck Berry for a second. I would argue that Chuck Berry had his own unique sound. You know, the Chuck Berry riff.
Yeah, yep.
I mean, that's a known guitar rock and roll riff that everybody, I remember seeing
like
Chuck Berry.
It's like a Bo Diddley riff, too.
Well, you know, Bo
Diddley.
Diddley. So I remember seeing Pete Townsend, Bo Diddley, and Chuck Berry. And Pete Born and Brack on, so one open, one was second, and then The Who. Before they even started, Chuck brought both of them out and did 30 minutes playing, you know, their riffs with them. And that was like, holy crap.
Well, so I mean, and I'll say, Chuck Berry, you know, maybe there's a trio or, a group of four, you know, you get Chuck Berry and Little Richard, and you get, you know, I mean, there's, you know, Great Balls of Fire, you know, you got Jerry Lee Lewis. You get these, like, three or four guys in the 50s that basically invented, like, a zillion things that everybody had to learn how to play if you wanted to be in rock.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was not only the riffs, but it's like the makeup of songs. Here's how the songs are going to be like. It's like, and this is. And
they're all constructed very similarly.
They are, but they were never constructed before. I mean, this is sort of a new deal. And the Crickets sort of took that a different way. There's another whole, you know. And the fact that they got to play at the Apollo became mm-hmm. a really huge deal. And then you have all the sort of the Apollo music actually created another riff in there. But back to your original comments, the Southern California scene of 64, 65, 66 probably is understated. But there's other people going doing things at the same time. Like Frank Zappa isn't part of that scene, but he is part of that scene.
So I'm going to take you to the next part of this conversation.
Dylan asked Zappa to produce his albums, and he said no. Zappa said no. Now, can you imagine a Dylan album produced by Frank Zappa?
No, I'm sorry. I don't have it. There's not enough acid in this world to imagine.
Oh, no. I think instead
Frank was an amazing producer.
Frank would have taken it as a challenge to make Dylan sound better, not to sound weird, but to sound better. And I don't know the story behind his refusal to, you know, that could take some research or something. But he did refuse to do it. But at the same time, people think that Frank Zappa would have changed Dylan. No, I don't think so. I think instead he would have made Dylan sound technically and electrically very different.
Well, certainly electrically better.
He might have brought in Zappa's stable of incredibly good guitarists that were technicians. Just, you know, because one thing we know about Zappa in the studio is he was like the maestro with an orchestra. Everyone's doing exactly what we want. It may sound like all chaotic, but it was down to a fine science that Zappa was just, you know.
That's why still to this day the Zappa Guitar Fest that goes on every single year with some of the greatest guitarists that will play. You know, you mentioned Zappa, part of the documentary at the end of it, you mentioned them as well. They talk about in Laurel Canyon, Zappa lived, as did Flo and Eddie,
right.
who were the guys from the Turtles. And they talk about the fact that at the end of 66, beginning of 67, as that era is starting to change, as Stephen Stills is branching out, as Neil Young is branching out, as they're starting to drift away from the bands that they were in 64, 65, the Zappa influence into that whole scene and how he'd come over and say, no, let me show you how to play that riff and come over and just sit with Stephen Stills and imagine that, Zappa teaching Stephen Stills, who is, as we all know, is a phenomenal guitarist and a phenomenal musician.
But I think Zappa was probably, you know, a decade ahead of most people's guitar skills back in those days.
I would argue maybe 3 decades. I think we're still discovering the orchestration.
So
again, going back for credit where credit is due, the orchestration of guys like Zappa, of guys like Brian Wilson, of Berry Gordy, were giving credit to the Motown sound, and even then later on the Philly sound, where they would bring in orchestras to play on the top 40 records. How many times did you hear an orchestra or an R&B until these guys started it? And then you'd have violins, and you'd have horns, and you'd have cellos, and you'd hear trombones,
I gotta say.
Well, now you're getting into the 70s when you start doing that stuff.
Yeah, but that was in the
60s. Or the
30s. Right.
So you got this whole pre-50s big band movement where that was it.
No question about it.
And I'll say these producers were not unschooled, like just born out of nowhere. They listened to music. They listened to Frank and all the big band sounds of the 50s and early 60s, still playing big bands and still being relevant. And they were in the recording studios. You know, Frank can be leaving while Frank Zappa's coming in.
It's actually interesting because you think about who was recording in California at that time. You had Frank Sinatra in the Capitol Records studio. You had Quincy Jones, who was lead chair, you know, and arranging, and then became the conductor.
Right.
You had Frank Zappa, who was showing up, and again, it's Columbia. You have Columbia Records down the block from New York. You had Cooper and Broomfield doing the East Coast thing with all the East Coast guys.
Right, so the East Coast is a whole different matter. And we haven't talked about that really, the New York sound, which was very different in the sense that they had it was a blues, jazz, horns thing going on that wasn't going on anywhere else. So this is
Hired Cooper and Broomfield, who can't believe I'm blocking his name, the major recording legend for Columbia Records. I got to remember. My brain is having
a moment over here.
We recorded Springsteen. Discovered Springsteen. Who discovered Springsteen?
I don't know.
It's the guy from Columbia Records.
So when I think about documentaries, there's another Bob Dylan documentary right now about his early days in the Village and becoming Bob Dylan. Everything before electric. And
Café Wa.
And what's interesting about it is what his relationship to recording studios, they had went nothing to do with electric. They were all folk.
Hammond. John Hammond.
And so when you think about it, goes from all folk to not all folk, but actually jazz, blues, horns. I mean, like a huge change in New York scene.
And I'm telling you, that was John Hammond.
Well,
I'm waiting for our beloved producer Bradley to pull it up over here and make sure that I'm not talking out of my you-know-what.
Well, you know, deep in the bunker here, the signal is slow, so it'll be a few minutes.
We'll come back to it.
But it's an interesting thing when you start talking about these early moments of American music history versus UK versus, well, those are really the two major areas. And I certainly don't know enough about European, German, you know, African, you know, Caribbean big dates or anything like that. But I'll say in the American music scene, you're right, 60s, early 60s, 64, 65, 66 was seminal. The recording industry changed, and the sort of the spheres of influence changed radically in the late 60s, with 67 through 70, partially because of Woodstock, partially because the Motown Detroit scene became legendary during that time frame, and partially because it became fractured, south and north, you know. And would you guys quit sharing your screens with each other?
It's John Hammond, who again was discoverer and original producer of Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Benny Goodman, Harry James, should I keep on going, Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Big Joe Turner, Pete Seeger, George Benson, Leonard Cohen, you want me to keep on going? Like the guy didn't do anything. Stevie Ray Vaughan, should I keep on going? In other words, he's also responsible for the discovery and revival of Robert Johnson.
So Columbia was a huge, huge
East Coast
deal.
Coast label, 53rd Street at 6th Avenue was a studio, marvelous studio. Frank did his early summer. Frank did a couple of recordings in there, but
and even with Hammond's legacy in Columbia, they still were pretty stodgy. Columbia was compared to some of the smaller groups that went on. Hammond may have been the one that innovated everything.
I didn't say he innovated. I'm saying that he was someone who would hear somebody and say, that's quality. That's talent.
There's an audience that I can make money
and you could argue, you know, he's not just a producer, you know, it's Clive Davis later on. It's somebody who it's Quincy Jones now, still to this day, who can hear something and say, oh my, that's gonna be something, or that is something. That's unpolished gold and I'm gonna polish it up. I mean, who was listening to I was lucky. I got to see Springsteen in Asbury Park in the early days. But, you know, and so if you were lucky enough to be one of the 300 or 400 people, you know, in the club there listening to them, you'd go, oh, man, that's a great band, because you were there and you felt the energy. But you get someone like John Hammond who walks into this and to your point, Bradley, I can make that guy a star.
And Springsteen was East Coast for many, many years before he
Jersey
moved west.
Had such a huge, though, music legacy. Everyone went to New York, of course. But
thank you, Valley.
But you do look at all the bands out of Jersey that are Jersey bands that all, you know, all talk about Jersey, but they don't live there anymore.
So, but they started, but it was because it was interesting because
they took their money and ran.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you could talk of it and reflect it a couple of ways. Here they are in the shadow of the big city of New York City across the river. They're not quite ready to make that, although it's a very short journey in terms of miles. Career wise, it's a round the world and back kind of journey to try to get to this, you know, the stage of, you know, in Frank's case, the Capitol Theater in the 50s when he becomes, you know, the megastar, or before that and everything else. So Bruce playing down in Asbury Park to go playing and, you know, selling out 12 straight nights in Madison Square Garden or what have you.
Right. Well, you know, but you see like Blue Oyster Cult and Patti Smith and, I mean, there's like a zillion Jersey bands that no one says, oh, Jersey girl, oh, Jersey guy, you know, because they've effectively left that.
It's a good job, Bon Jovi.
On the other hand, you know, Jersey guys like Bruce Springsteen, no. So wrote songs for Patti Smith, that, you know, like, and Patti Smith wrote songs for Blue Oyster Cult, and, you know, like, all this sort of like, they're all friends because they're all from Jersey. It's like the
Jersey. Should we hold that against them, or?
No.
How did he tie Patti Smith into this?
Because he has this internal love and
is
affection.
Is like the seven steps to Kevin Bacon type of thing?
No.
It is actually, because, you know, well, you can just...
just take
you start. You start with any rocker, and it's your seven steps from somebody.
He's just always been in love with Patti Smith.
I have. But this is an interesting conversation on the, you know, the whole, because what you're really getting after is some seminal points in American history, rock.
In American music.
Yeah, American.
I wouldn't
history.
Just call it rock. I'd call it because I started by talking about 65 to 67, yeah. You know, and you could potentially go back from there as you did in some of them and have that, or you have those go forward moments, you know, with Motown, and, you know, one could argue where in that progression of 63, 62, when they started to have their first radio hits, did Barry Gordy realize that he could build a machine? And it was a machine. It was almost like taking the Ford Motor Company assembly line and saying, okay, you have the next hour. You guys need to write a song about love, and we're doing it for the Supremes. Oh, it's a song about heartbreak. Oh, we'll do that for the Four Tops. By the way, did you ever notice that the Four Tops songs are always about heartbreak, or that they lost a girl, versus the Temptations are about love and about winning the girl? It's not always the case, but most of the songs were like that. I don't know if anybody's ever done that track, but that's an interesting sort of...
That is interesting. And any stuff that, I mean, growing up in that part of the world in the 60s, we were front and center for that.
I mean, think about Bernadette. Bernadette, which is a phenomenal, Levi Stubbs, screaming his heart out. He's crying because he wants his Bernadette standing in the shadows of love, right? He's, you know... There's, you know, as compared to My Girl, right? Or, you know, or just love songs.
And so. Smokey had just the groove.
Well, but the thing is that Smokey, so Barry would say to Smokey, oh, you're writing a song for the Tops, and he knew what the Tops meant, and or you're running a short for the Temptations, and you knew what that meant. Walden's going to argue. He's going to say I'm wrong.
No, no, no. You, I'm, no, I'm, I was probably, say,
I'm probably about half, a little bit more than half right.
No, so if you look at almost all rock and roll songs, with the exception of maybe the Beatles, they fall into heartbreak and love songs. And it's like, it's like, yeah, there's three categories. It's like, you know.
Absolutely. But
lost
all
the
I'm
girl,
saying
got
is,
the
that,
girl.
Is that the Four Tops always seem to get the heartbreak song, where the Temptations always got the love song. And I'm... Walden's having a heartbreak moment over here. It's a little bit of a heartbreak hotel moment for Walden.
Well, actually, sitting here listening, you just given me, I'm writing down over here, one of our genres that we need to kind of explore a little bit farther will be the sounds of the town. Like, really delve into Southern California, really delve into Detroit, really delve into Philly, really delve into, you know, the South and the Texas, you know, I mean, even some of the stuff that comes up
so
from there.
I mean, so you talk about Detroit. You know, and everybody talks about Berry Gordy and Motown and stuff like that. But there was that whole big rock and roll scene, the Motor City Madman himself.
Yeah, there's a ton of rock and roll that came. There was a ton of music that came out of Detroit.
Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels.
Yeah.
The MC5.
The MC5.
You had Bob
Seger. Who, by the way? No, I'm just going to say.
Bob Seger.
You had Seger coming out of Ann Arbor. You had
Bob Seger.
You know, all these bands, and it's interesting because each of them had their own era. I mean, the Spinners came out of Detroit, and you just like,
did the Spinners first come out of Detroit?
I think
before
they were Philly,
they moved,
before they moved,
before they moved to Philly.
Forth.
Did Berry Gordy not want to sign them?
I'm not sure that I started reading
actually,
some stuff the other
really
day.
There's some really
interesting
stories about people that Berry Gordy didn't sign that became huge. It was like, and then like, and they went to Philly, did this or whatever. Like they're like sort of like, you know. Why didn't he sign him?
Yeah, well, first of all, Leon Huff and Tom Bell were geniuses on their own.
Right.
Because they were able to figure out that, okay, I just need to take what Berry Gordy is doing, change four things, and I will get
done.
And it's sort of easy.
Move him to Philly and put an orchestra behind him.
Exactly.
We're all set.
You put TSOP behind the Sound of Philadelphia
there
behind him, and I could get away with almost mimicking the sound, whether it was the Spinners. God,
that's interesting. I mean, you're talking styles earlier. I mean, we started off in Laurel Canyon, and we kind of went up to the East Coast, and now we're looking at the Midwest, shall we say, but it's interesting how all these
the Phillies, not
types,
the Midwest,
types of music, East, I mean, like Detroit and, you know, Chicago coming down through there. It's interesting.
We didn't touch Chicago yet.
We haven't got Chicago yet.
But Chicago. Rock is an odd thing with Chicago.
But they have
but
there.
Blues are not an
blues
odd thing, but
are
blues.
Like
but it's really interesting when you sit down and you listen and you're fans of music like we are, and all of these different... you know, they play off of each other. Like you say, Seven Steps to Patti Smith. Everybody knows that there's music that just kind of like rolls. It's like, hey, that's a great idea. And it moves in and it turns in and explodes in one area and then it moves into another area. And it's really kind of interesting.
So you talk about
that
for a moment. So why did Chicago become, and probably still in some people's minds, the blues capital of the world?
Chicago's blues had their own style versus Memphis blues and W.C.
Well,
Handy
but
versus,
so, but it became you know. The it became a blues place because of all these people fleeing the South to go up north to get away from all the horrible things going on in the South.
But it's a different genre of blues than you find, and so versus the Memphis blues or the New Orleans blues or the. I mean, there are blues capitals that had instrumental writers writing there and playing there. Chicago blues, the sound of Chicago blues is so much bigger and bolder than Memphis blues. Memphis blues is, I think, more traditional blues, but it's. You know, you get that whole Ella Fitzgerald on the one hand, and you get Muddy Waters on the other, and you just like, this is Chicago's got this deep, deep, rich sound that you don't find elsewhere. And I don't
know. Thank God for the Chess Brothers.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what they did, and their willingness to invest the money and build that studio there, and record the Muddy Waters and the Howling Wolves, and all those
people came
phenomenal
there. So this is what's more interesting. Yeah, these aren't homegrown.
The right.
These are people coming from around the country.
Around the world, Rolling Stones paying homage and going to, you know, the Chess Records studio to, you know, to go record in that studio because they wanted to be able to say that they sang on the same microphone in the same room as the guys that they just, you know, looked up to, that they idolized. You know, that I remember going to a Stones concert on Lincoln Avenue in the early 70s, where the Stones at that point were megastars, and they were playing in a 300-person club on Lincoln Avenue in Muddy Waters Club, just wailing away, and people were pressed up against the glass. You know, I think recently the guy on CBS who did the thing with McCartney in Liverpool, he did the same thing. He brought McCartney to the local pub where McCartney used to play, James Corden, and did it was a TV special. So that obviously wasn't, you know, I don't think I've ever seen a film of this thing. I was there, so I remember it. But it was that moment where people pressed up against the glass outside and onto the street because they could hear, they had the doors open, and you could hear, you know, Mick and Charlie and all these guys playing with them, and you're going, oh, crap, this is real.
So this is actually McGuire and Gwynn and McGuire.
McGuire and McGuinn.
Yeah.
Couldn't get high.
Right. Well, so writing So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star.
Exactly.
And this was a 66 song published in 67, which sort of is the...
Who wrote that? McGuire wrote that or McGuinn?
I think it was McGuire. I'd have to look that up.
But
So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, just pick up a guitar, learn how to play, you know. You know, it's like it's the perfect little sort of song for that era and for that, you know, for that group. You know, if you're talking about all these Laurel Canyon, just pick up a guitar, learn how to play, you know, write a song, you'll hit the charts and they'll tear you apart.
So Michelle Phillips on the documentary, which again I want to give a shout out to. Yep. It's a great documentary. It's the new documentary done by Jacob Dylan, the son of Bob Dylan, Echoes in the Canon. They're interviewing Michelle Phillips, and she talks about the moment driving down the Laurel Canyon and her and Mama Cass are in the car, and they go, hey, that's McGuinn and McGuire. They're on the radio. Hell, if they can get a record on the radio, we surely can. So they call up Lou Adler and say to Lou Adler, you need to listen to us. And they go down to Western Studio. They actually, you know, reenacted, and they sang, you know, California Dreamin' and about four other songs. And Lou said, okay, go home the next day and come back the next day. The next day they had contracts all over the floor and they're all signing up, and they record the very first Mamas and the Papas album. 2 days later, after they heard McGuinn and McGuire on the radio. So
this is, I think it's, again, it's a seminal time. It's fascinating that Laurel Canyon has this history, because it becomes a hotbed, and then the stars find it, and it becomes sort of an odd place, you know, with the unfortunate history of that,
but that's later.
Right, that's directly afterwards.
But you think about that. So why did Charlie Manson go back to that? Because he ran into one of the Beach Boys and said, I want to be a rock and roll star. I could play guitar. Almost your quote. And they said, ah, you know, you should go up and visit us
where
you were at this house. So they give them the house, which is not the house that they're in. It's the Tate House.
Right. No, this is, it's all, Laurel Canyon is a hotbed of activity of music, and then the stars move in, because after all, musicians are cool, but actresses want to be cool. Actors want to be cool. They move in afterwards.
And then they want to hang out with musicians.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. No, they do, because, well, you know, I won't say it. But it's a fascinating little place. I don't know if you've been to Laurel Canyon, but it driving through it feels like you're going through history just because you know it's all around you. But it's a to me, it's I haven't seen the documentary, so I will see it now. I'm gonna go. You know, it's on my list of. There's another couple documentaries I want to see. There's a punk one that is just being released on Epix, and there's a couple others that I want to see. But this sounds fascinating. I would love to do a time slice history. As you know, I get all
right.
keyed up on, you know, dates and connections to see when people release things.
But, you know, again, so
a big whiteboard that has every little tidbit on it.
Right, the track on it. But you know, there's one clip in there of Neil Young, Stephen Stills doing Mr. Soul, and
acoustic or electric?
No, electric, and it's for like Hullabaloo or something like that, and I'm like, my brain is exploding in my head because I'm realizing that, oh, I remember that. Oh, I remember that. Oh my God, I remember that. You know, those sort of. That, you know, we were of that era where we got to see
it for the first time.
I mean, seeing the, you know, so they played a Beatles clip and they played, there were some other bands they were showing, you know, that were on Sullivan for the first time. And it's incredible. Oh, the Beach Boys on Ed Sullivan. They say, so Ed Sullivan says, so who's in charge? And they all look to Brian. He says, well, I guess I am. I write, I produce, I arrange everything. And I tell them all what to do. Oh, my. What a great era.
It was. I must say I was too young.